Okay, now we're on. This is technologically problem night. Okay, now in chapter 5, we have Belshazzar, not Belteshazzar. Belshazzar, king of Babylon, co-regent at that time, and we have the handwriting on the wall.
Hello.
And so as we relate to that...
Here's the number.
And...
Here's the number.
We are trying to get everybody on board here.
Yeah.
Okay, go to Daniel 5. We're going to start. We're going to tag along. For those who... realize the way I handle it, I have a King James Version, but I normally run off the Aramaic here.
066.
So what I'm reading is more my translation, though it's founded on the AV, the King James.
Yeah.
And so, so in Daniel 5, it starts out, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to a thousand of his lords and drank wine before the thousand. And so you have a thousand individuals in a meeting hall in Babylon. It's a large place, and there's enough for this many people. We don't know how many more, but we know a minimum of a thousand people. And he invites them to this great, great feast, and they... it's interesting as he begins, Belshazzar, not, oh, I did say something earlier, it's not Belteshazzar, which was Daniel's name in Aramaic, but this is a legitimate, real king, and co-regent to the end of the Babylonian Empire. Belshazzar, while verse 2, Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded, and when the king speaks, it's a command, and I can say that because it actually says he spoke, and he said he spoke or commanded to bring the gold and the silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. So you have the immediate retinue of the king who were also present, and he demanded that they bring these vessels from the temple in Jerusalem. Now, why he did it, we don't know. Though it seems very clear that he was not happy with the way Jehovah was functioning in the kingdom, because at that time, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had some kind of a role in the kingdom. Now, it says that he was Nebuchadnezzar's, or his father was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, that gives us an illustration of what happens. In the Old Testament, the word father doesn't have to mean the immediate father. In this case, it's his grandfather. And so he was put on the throne. Pardon me. That sneeze has been working me over. Hope that's the last of many. And so it was his grandfather. We'll see this reference made to him, Nebuchadnezzar, in this way in verses 11, 13, and 18. And so he is of the direct lineage of Nebuchadnezzar. And verse 3, they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes and wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, brass, and of iron, and wood, and stone. And it almost sounds like that maybe it's a little bit of blasphemy against that vision that Nebuchadnezzar had had probably about 45 years before. So they drink to the deities of Babylon, and that collection, and so this is, again, it's a blasphemous act where they're saying these gods are as good as Jehovah of Israel, and so they bring these from the temple in Jerusalem, and so they drank wine and praised the gods of gold, and we see that very clear in 4. Now, how many vessels were there available? It's interesting because we do have a record of what Nebuchadnezzar had brought from from Jerusalem because they were returned in Ezra. And so let me read from Ezra chapter 1 and verse 7. King Cyrus also brought out the articles of the house of Jehovah, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem, and put in the temple of his gods. Down in verse 9, the King James says, "And this is the number of them: 30 chargers or gold dishes of gold, and 1,000 chargers of silver, 29 knives, 30 basins of gold, silver basins of a second sort, 410, other vessels, 1,000. All of the vessels of gold and silver were 5,400. All of these did Sheshbazzar bring with them of the captivity when they were brought up from Babylon unto Jerusalem." Were there enough to handle 1,000 plus? You bet. It has more than 5,000 vessels were taken. And there are different kinds. You have different terms in this matter. You have their golden dishes, their chargers. There were vessels to catch blood in sacrifices. So they brought these valuable vessels, and so there was plenty. Sometimes I've heard people say, "Oh, there couldn't have been that many." No, God's word says that when Israel went back to the land with the decree of Cyrus, they had adequate vessels for this big feast that was thrown in Babylon. And so what happens? They've had time to do some drinking, but then it says in the same hour in verse 5, at that very hour, what happens? We have an appearance. It's interesting because I need to talk a little bit about some of the way they handle things in those days. Usually, because you didn't have a great deal of light, it was candlelight or torchlight. On a big room, it took a lot of it. So generally, in order to get adequate light in a room, they used a lot of lime. That is whitewash. And so it was white, so it would reflect the light. And so it was a white wall, and I'm sure there were more lights in the podium or the rostrum where Belshazzar was. And so he's sitting there, getting rather loaded, as it were. And suddenly what happens, there is an appearance of this hand. It says, "Then in the same hour came fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote." The word "part" is a word that we have in the Hebrew language, which has the idea of the palm of the hand. It would appear that the flat of his hand came across, and the words began to appear, and the letters began to appear. Now, many will think that this language was hocus pocus. It was not hocus pocus. And we will be looking at those, and if you skim down in your text, you're going to see some capitalized letters at the end. You have many, many tekel upharsin. Many, many tekel upharsin in verse 25. They're capitalized in most texts, and those are Aramaic words. These were not words that they did not know. Now, if you're drunk and it appears in a certain way, then you might not understand what was going on. And we're going to talk about that as we get further into this. But he sees the palm of a man's hand, and these letters appear. And they're normal old Aramaic letters. And he writes, and the king sees the hand. It's kind of interesting. The thing that's important to him is that he sees a hand. He can't figure out where it came from. He doesn't see attached to anything. So this hand is a mobile hand moving along the wall, no elbow, no arm, and no other body parts attached. And so as this takes place, it's writing. In verse 6, the king's countenance or splendor or color was changed, and his thoughts were alarmed. The word troubled in your King James is the idea of not just being troubled. I mean, he is startled, like in an alarm situation. He was so alarmed that he had a difficulty that resulted. And you can see it here. And I think the obscurity of the King James is done in good taste. And what he says, so that the joints of his loins were loosened. Then he goes on into these knees smote together. And so what happened? He is so shaken up, and it says the joints of his loins were loosed. I have to laugh when I look at the form because they hit it. It actually it says loosed themselves. It's a reflexive. It's in Aramaic ithbael, like a ithbael in Hebrew. And so they happen on them. I mean, they just let go. And he had a major accident. And his knees smote together against one another. It doesn't mean he was knock-kneed. They did knock, though, in this case. And so they knocked together, and we had a big, and there was a big problem on the platform, as it were, at the head table. And so the king is in a state, and it says in verse 7, the king cried aloud. He cried with power. He called out with power to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon when they came, it seems like they like to call these fancy religious advisors in rather often, and every time they do, it begins to set the lines for the war of the gods. And so the gauntlet is down. They have the job of figuring out what it was that they saw. And so he brings them in, and he says, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed in scarlet. And there's a question of whether you want to translate that scarlet or purple. And have a gold chain about his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now it's interesting, the opportunity to be treated as royalty. Wear a color that was the royal color. In China, there was a color, if you were caught wearing it in one of the dynasties, and if you were caught wearing it, you were dead. And that was yellow. And so I can't remember the dynasty all of a sudden. But if you wore, that was the royal color in China. So that was a special color reserved for royalty and especially the king. A chain was something that was a special marker of a position of privilege. We will see a chain circumstance in the events that surround Esther and the rewarding of Mordecai in the end of the book of Esther. And this was a special thing. And beyond that, the third realm, he became the third realm, yes. He becomes third in the realm. And being third in the realm meant that he was number three ruler. Now, we know that what was happening was this was a co-regency. And so Nabonidus was a co-regent. Belshazzar was a co-regent at this time. He could not offer any of these individuals the second in the kingdom because he was not the only regent. And so it makes some good sense as we read it and understand it. And so in verse 8, then came all the king's wise men. It seems like there were even others who joined them, and they did not have the power to read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation thereof. It was funny. Why couldn't they read their own language? I mean, there's this writing, and it should have been easy to read. I don't have a good picture to show of the Sonsino commentary. And it's just probably not going to show on there. It's on the cover here. And you see there, you can see, if you can see it at all, we had trouble with this before. But there you see fingers, and you see them, and the letters are up and down in this picture. This is a Jewish commentary in the way they look at it. So let's look at it in a different manner, because I believe that's exactly what happened. And what happened, I think we had something that came... Oops, let's get it right.
Backwards.
Okay. Okay. Down on the bottom here, I put the Hebrew letters in. That are already Aramaic letters. And I believe that what happened, they were, instead of many, many tekel upharsin, and I put lines in this, the red lines are marking them up and down. Aramaic reads from right to left. It's not a Chinese that doesn't go from top to bottom. I mean, doesn't go up and down. It's right to left. And so when they saw this, they probably could not put it. You know, you put a little ethyl alcohol in somebody's mind, they might see something very obvious and not recognize it. And so this was the way it would have been, I think. And I mark it out here. What's on the top of that sheet is probably the way it looked to them, because they didn't have lines on it. And so many, many tekel upharsin, or the letters, and I think that's the way they saw it, and they couldn't figure them out. And if you look in the Aramaic, you're not going to find, let me look at this so I get it right, you don't have the mum mum ta us, or os, that would be up here on this. So I think that was part of the problem. These guys were not dummies. They knew their native language, and when they look at it, they see letters that are theirs. They're letters that are very familiar, but they don't make sense. Then when they, if they were to figure them out, they still couldn't figure out, because they're prophetic in nature. And we see that as this event progresses. And so he calls them in, and you know, kings tend to get a little unhappy. And this one does, too. Here's a king. I would be unhappy, too, if I'd had the accident he did. And then in verse 9, it says, then was Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him. That is, his appearance was changed in him. And his lords were astonished. They were confused, totally confused. And when we see that word troubled in this context, it's interesting, because it's one of those reflexive forms in the Aramaic. That is, he was agitated himself. He got worse and worse. It built to a climax in that matter. And so it's interesting, the picture. So he was getting mad. He was unhappy. This was something he couldn't explain. And so he wanted them to, and they should have been able to. Well, he was so upset, he went to Mama, the queen. Maybe the queen mother would be better. Most believe that this was the queen mother, that is Nebuchadnezzar's wife, one of his wives. Now the queen, verse 10, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came unto the banquet house. Now she wasn't among all of these mucky-mucks at the head table. She heard the word and had time to come. She speaks and said, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts trouble you. Don't let them terrify you. Don't let them alarm you. Nor let your countenance, your face, be changed. Your appearance to be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. Interesting. I believe that should be, it should be plural, as it is in form, in this, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, Allah, grandfather, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king, Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, O king, I say thy father, and again she's talking grandfather, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. And so this was, I said 40-some years before. If you read, sit down and figure it out, it's 65 years before. Long time before, history had kind of gone its way. You've gone from Nebuchadnezzar's death in 562 BC. You've gone through a couple of other kings, that you have evil Merodach, who was assassinated. He only ruled a couple of years. Nergalesser is another king, and he lived about reigned about 4 years, and then you come to this co-regency that's right around the. But you have all of this assassination and stuff that's going on with the kings in this. So this report, the queen mother is an old lady, and she comes and marches in, and she treats him with respect, and he was at a loss for to know what to do. And in verse 12, it goes on to say, she says, "Forasmuch as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding and interpreting of dreams and showing hard sentences," I like that because it actually could be translated declaring riddles, answering riddles, "and dissolving of knots," untangling of knots. The word dissolve, a dissolver of, and the word doubts is knots. In the Aramaic. So he handles the hard stuff. What a commentary on Daniel. Now, Daniel is not a spring chicken. Daniel has probably gone into retirement. At this point in Daniel's life, he's probably pretty close to 90 years old. And so he is, in a position of respect, but others had taken his place. And so she explains that he should be able, it says, let Daniel be called. And she uses his, I need to go back to the middle of that verse. Those were all found in Daniel. The rest of the verse says, whom the king named Belteshazzar. This is a relationship to the god of Babylon of Bel. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show you the interpretation. And it's kind of interesting. That reputation is pretty good when she gives him a pretty much an indicative statement that is going to happen. And so, he comes in, the old man. He must have been in pretty good shape. Because when we see him a little later, I'm surprised he survived just to fall into the lion's den in a little bit later in the 90s of his life. And so that invitation comes, and then Daniel was brought, verse 13. He was caused to go in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, not Belteshazzar, but Daniel. You Daniel? Are you that Daniel? Noticing it's italics in the text. Are you the Daniel which is of the sons of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry, brought him back from Israel? So he identifies him. It's kind of interesting. He must have had some of that history. Verse 14, I have even heard of thee. Or concerning you, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and cause to make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. When we work in hermeneutics, that's the class on interpretation, we go through some of these words translated interpretation. This is not an interpretation from Aramaic into Hebrew or like it is in, or into Greek as it is in the New Testament, but this is taking and interpreting something and getting its real significance. And that's the focus that we have here. And so he said they couldn't show the interpretation to me. And I, emphatic, and it's interesting, it's the king's always got to throw a little weight around. I have heard of thee that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve or untie knots. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. And so he makes the same offer. And it's rather interesting here when we read this little segment that Daniel and his God are their last resort. The last resort for the king to determine what was going on. It shocked him so much that he was overwhelmed, and he went the best he thought he had, and finally, as a last shot at it, he gets Daniel in, and he is confronted by a monotheistic prophet. Daniel's called a prophet in the New Testament, and so he comes and he makes the same offer. Now you'll notice Daniel could hardly wait to get it. Things offered. No. Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let thy gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another." And it's kind of interesting. The word that he uses for rewards here could be translated fee. It's only used back in the Hebrew side of it in 2:6, but it's what you committed yourself to as a fee in this matter. And so he says, "You keep it for yourself." And yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. I'm going to do it. I don't want anything from you. It's kind of interesting because of what he's going to consider here, because of the prophecy that's within these words and what will happen within hours. And that prophecy and the many, many tekel upharsin will be fulfilled before the whole night is out. And we will talk about that when we get there. And so he says he's going to do that. Now, it's interesting. Daniel seems to like to do a little lengthy preface before he does these things. It's like he wants to keep him on edge. And so so what happens, he says in 18, "O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom, and majesty and glory and honor." Well, there's a lot of history there. In 237, there's a description of it in the image. When he says, "Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. You're the head of gold." And so he uses that as an emphasis. Yeah, you're the head of gold. Then he goes ahead and talks about what he has. And like I mentioned back there, it's almost like Nebuchadnezzar is good. As long as I can survive, who cares about the rest of my family? He didn't really do that, but he came awful close. Verse 19, I can't read my numbers. Not when you have notes around them. And for majesty that he gave him, all people to nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he kept alive, he would set up, and whom he would put down, he put down. Whom he would or he desired, he put down. The word "would" in the King James, you have four of them here, and they're all root words, the same root word, and has the idea whom pleased. It was pleasing to him. He didn't have to have a reason except it was his own personal pleasure. So he could establish kings or establish honor. Sorry about this. I think I'm in the beginnings of what a lot of other people have here, and that I will not pass it through the computer on that matter. No, I have backup here. And so he had all power. Remember, the head of gold was an absolute potentate. He was singular sovereign. We're going to see a little later that the Medes and the Persians, they split power. And you couldn't make a decree without having the other side. You'd made it, and the other side had to approve it. And if it didn't approve it, it was done. And we'll see that in the lion's den. And so he takes us back to chapter 4. And when his... Pardon me. I'm trying to thwart my sneezes. See, now don't say "God bless you" if I sneeze, because I'm blessed with all heavenly blessings in the heavenlies. Anyway, that's my new reaction to this. kind of thing. Okay, and he goes back to chapter 4 when he says, and when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened, and the word mind in the first instance is spirit, ruach, in the Aramaic. In his pride, he was deposed. He was brought down from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like that of the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like an oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of the heavens, until he knew that the Most High ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointed it over it whomsoever he will. Now, he's pretty kind in that statement. Because in chapter 4, he says he put the least of men, the worst of men, in power. And here, Daniel is a little bit more civil in the way he handles it. And so he reminds him, and thou his son, the word son is the word bar, like bar mitzvah in Aramaic. It's kind of funny how bar mitzvah is an Aramaic word for a Hebrew event. O Belshazzar, has not humbled your heart. You haven't put it low, made it low, though thou knewest all of this. You had the history. History is of value. History is important. And so it's very clear here. You knew all of this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord. It's an Aramaic word which isn't found very often. The Lord of the heavens. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy nobles or lords, thy wives, thy concubines, have drunk wine in them, and have praised the gods of silver, gold, brass, iron, wood. And we have an interference with our camera. that's the Daniel cat. Anyway.
Yeah, it's an evening school mascot.
and you said you brought them, I mean, in honor of the gods that can't see, can't hear, can't know anything, and the God whose hand in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, this God, and this is a writing that was written. I'm catching.
Let's all start blowing our noses then.
Yeah, we could have a
chorus
or a band. Gabriel, blow your horn.
Trombone.
Okay, now this is what happened. This is what it says. And like I say, they're up and down, I believe. I don't believe they were linear like was normally written. This is a writing which was written many tekel upharsin. He says the interpretation of this is, many, God has manied thy kingdom and finished it. The word many is a word that means number, to number. It's a very common kind of Semitic term. We have mana is a word in Hebrew, and this is in Aramaic. But God has numbered your kingdom and has completed it, brought it to its end, brought it to its completion. And so it's very clear. Your kingdom is over. Tekel. Does tekel sound like shekel? There is a relationship between the Hebrew shekel and the tekel. You can see it says you are weighed in the balances. A shekel was a weight of coinage. It is today in Israel. A tekel, you are weighed in the balances of the scales, and you are found wanting. You are found on your part coming up short. And so you made yourself be found that way. He uses a reflexive in here. Paris, upharsin. U is an and. And so Paris is our root. So you wonder where that comes from. Doesn't look like that word, but it's the root behind it. And it says, thy kingdom is divided. The word paras means to divide, or cut. It's divided, and given to the Medes and Persians. It's all over, Belshazzar. The end. And Belshazzar, what does he do? He's a good king, you know. He made a promise. Daniel said no, so what does the king do? It says, then commanded, or he said, Belshazzar, that they clothe Daniel in scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and make a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third in ruler in the kingdom. So we've come, and it seems like maybe I've been hustling a little. I have, on purpose, because we need to talk a little history. I can tell you the night in which this feast took place. I can give you the date, even. And it's interesting because it is a well-known date in history. And, yes, I can tell you. It's right here in front of me somewhere. Okay, if I can't find it there, I know it's here. It's Columbus Day, 539 B.C., October 12th, 539 B.C. That's the date of the fall of the Babylonian Empire. So that date is well known in history, and so in our calendar it would be October 12th of that year. And so here you have this predicted destruction. Now, I think we had these on the internet. If you didn't, I don't know that these show well. The city of Babylon was a very majestic city. We have indication of the size and shape of it. And on the internet, these are among those charts that came on there. And I'm going to just put it where I hope you can see it. On it. Now that is a map that comes out of a book on Babylon, and you can see, if you were to look close, if you pulled it off, you'll see there are temples all around. I won't try to poke around this to make it look good, but you have temples. There are temples on each quadrant. You have a temple here. I said I wasn't going to do this. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 temples. But what I want you to see in this, and this is a representation of it, is an artist's representation of what was taking place, because you have these great temples, and the river Euphrates runs right through the middle of the city of Babylon. And so what they had were walls around that city. So it was the city walls, there was a wall banks of this river. There was a long tunnel underneath it, so you could go under it. At night, they had a bridge, and if you happen to get it, you can see that one. It was a single bridge. It was gated, so they shut it up at night. The only access you had back and forth was to go through this tunnel underneath the river. And so they were celebrating because this city was a city of such magnitude. You could have horse races on the city wall. It was so wide. And that was, they said, you could run 4 chariots abreast across the top of that wall. Depending on who you read, that wall, in one of the ancient writers, you have an account of it in Herodotus, you have it in Strabo, the geographer, and I think the highest was like 150 feet tall. That's a 15-story wall. I mean, it's a very, very tall and wide, huge wall. The supplies in Babylon were said to have been so much that they could have lasted for years and years and years. They were impregnable when it came to military attack. Now, what happened? The Medes and the Persians were assaulting Babylon. Cyrus was the general of the Persian army, and their strategy was pretty clever. That is, if the Babylonians had such a well-defended city, and the river ran right through it, they used the river as a defense of a sort, but the walls along the side of the river were far smaller, lower. And so what happened? They went upstream, and they did a diversion of the Euphrates. They took a bunch of slaves up there, and they essentially dammed the river and diverted it. And that night, they had diverted it completely, and so they sent troops under the walls of Babylon. And they came in, and the history tells us that what was happening while they were having the big party. They didn't have as heavy a guard as they needed, and so what happened, the Persians came through, got over the wall out of the river, and they came and opened the gates of Babylon before the Babylonians knew it. And all of a sudden, the city's wide open, and you've got a bunch of drunken leaders, and they came and they assaulted them, and I think we have a little bit of a record of what happened in that assault. And like I say, it was October 12th in 539, and the account ends in this way. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. He died. I always like this, because when I learned my Hebrew, our paradigms were on the verb kill, katal. And it occurs more in the Aramaic in the Old Testament than it does in the Hebrew. It's just an easy form to build paradigms on. So he was killed. Kind of permanentized, permanently dead. And this, I smile because it's a participle. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So Darius the Mede, took the kingdom, and he managed that. Now, there's a lot of question about Darius the Mede. What does it say here? It says he took the kingdom. What kingdom? Kingdom of Babylon. Which part of the kingdom of Babylon? I think he's talking primarily about the city and the province of Babylon. Now, not the whole thing, because there was a division of authority between the Medes and the Persians. The Medes were up north of Babylon in the hill country. They were kind of semi-primitive. They were fierce warriors, but they weren't as well civilized as it were as the Persians. And so, but they were up north and a little bit to the west of where Shushan was. It became, ultimately, when the fall of Babylon took place, where that became one of the primary palace cities of the Persians. And so that was when they fell. So the very night they saw the handwriting on the wall, this all added up. It came to an head, and it was numbered, and the number was a short one in this case, and they were weighed in the balances, and they didn't match, and they use that metallurgical term, and then the kingdom was divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So the Medes and Darius the Mede, they said, well, we don't have a record of him. Cyrus was the king. Well, he was a sub-ruler under Cyrus, and that development as time went on, because with Cyrus, Cyrus is a guy that gave the decree, because he became the king of Persia. He gave the decree for Israel to go back, and that's recorded in the book of Ezra. In fact, that's why Ezra also has Aramaic, because the decrees are in Aramaic, and so when we learn a little Aramaic, we learn it for these sections of Daniel, and then we learn it for that. So it seems to me that when we read this, that we are in round five, and it sounds to me like the score is now 30-0. It seems like Jehovah's won this one pretty well, hands down, because Babylon's no longer in the game. They lose it, but then we're going to do some flashbacks in six, because we have Daniel's role a little earlier. We end up with this issue of the Dan Alliance, and this is over the Persians. Very interesting when we think of it. Now, you might think of this just for fun, and that is when we look at the Dan Alliance, why didn't they burn Daniel in the fiery furnace? Interesting problem. Why would they throw him to lions? how did this work? And I'll try to draw you some kind of a diagram to give you some sense of how the lion's den was. It wasn't a cage in the zoo. They didn't do it that way. And usually they did not have metal bars that they used. I mean, iron was a little brittle, and they didn't have enough brass to make them. So they usually would use another mechanism to have a lion's den. And we'll give, how am I going to do this? I'm going to try to give some diagrams. I'll try to make them so you can see them on the net.
You can draw.
Oh, okay. Maybe I can try some of my unarty work on that. But that's where we're headed next, the lion's den. Hey, you'll notice here we've gone through material. It's, God is in charge. Jehovah is completely in charge. Absolutely 100% in charge. And you can be a little Jew in the land of Babylon, and your God can win. And that's what happened. And Daniel is a Jew that's put in there in a way that, I mean, he wasn't a great, great specimen of a man. And then they mutilated him, so he was not functioning well. And yet, his God is a winner. He's a winner. Always a winner. And when we see that in our lives, we can be reminded. Now, I'm reminded one of the uses of the Old Testament, we learn some things about God. And one of them is, he doesn't lose. Never. And that's where we are in this element of the War of the Gods. Okay, let's pray. Thank you, Father, for the evening, for the opportunities. We've moved through these verses rather quickly, but we're thankful that at least we can get a little bit of a handle on what's going on and the way you're moving in the affairs of men. We appreciate it, and we're grateful for the fact that you saw fit to put this book in the Bible. Some have disliked it for the very reasons that we love it. The ones who don't like Daniel deny it supernatural because they say they're just myths and fairy tales. We who believe your word for what it says, we see it as the absolute truth and not full of error. And so we have faith because we understand the way you put Scripture together. May you bless the next hour. May you get glory through it. And we'll thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Now you can take a break. Thank you.
Do you think that's where the saying, the writing on the wall, came from?
Oh, yes. And you see the writing on the wall.
This is a done deal.
Yep.
Interesting. That's in our language.
What is in our language?
Writing on the wall.
Yeah.
It's in our language.
In the idioms.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize it's a movie that I've seen uses this term. You've been weighed.
Oh, weighed in the balances and found wanting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah. Pastor Dave.
You're welcome.
Hi, Jan.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm wonderful.
Well, you look wonderful. I can see you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
and you look pretty good too, little girl.
Well, I'm fat and sassy, as usual.
I don't believe it for a minute.
Dang.
Maybe sassy.
Yes, definitely sassy, at the very least. I'm going to give you back to someone better looking here.
If you want to see Caleb, you have to say hi to Caleb.
Yes, you have to see Caleb. Wait, his head's cut off.
His head's cut off.
He's so tall.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Oh, my gosh, he even sounds bigger.
Sounds bigger.
Bigger. We're on our way to go pick up Gabe now, so.
All right.
Have a good evening.
Darlene, what's
your name? Actually, Jeff has her car right now.
Oh.
And he's supposed to be bringing back. She's hoping to make it for the second class.
Okay. Okay.
Well, they had a little bit of a disaster trying to get their car fixed. And Jeff was going to be changing the ball joint for them, but they ended up, the place gave them the wrong one.
Oh. It happened.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the recorder.
So what? Oh, you can turn it off?
Yeah.
Or do you want us to take it?